Why is the shopping cart always in the top right of the screen?
How do companies predict my purchases?
Why do prices end in 9?
Why do fast food companies use red and yellow in their logos?
Why do restaurants always have one expensive menu item?
Researchers, marketers, and very curious people seek the answers for how we make decisions and how we choose products. ClickSuasion finds the secrets that companies use and shares them with you.
Why do I feel better when I bought the last remaining airline ticket?
How do I make choices based on colors and fonts?
And this is Paul Sullivan welcoming you back to another episode of Rock the Block. Today's interview is with Michael Barbera, and I thought I'd bring something different to the mix. Instead of interviewing a blockchain entrepreneur, I've interviewed someone that should give you some insight onto how you should go about developing your blockchain business. And I think Michael, having worked with some of the biggest brands in the world, focuses on customer psychology. And I'm going to introduce him properly. So our guest is likely to ruin your next shopping experience. He researches how people make decisions. Hint, they are often irrational. He is a researcher and advisor on consumer behavior, decision making, and persuasion. And during his research with ClickSuasion Labs, he has analyzed an unhealthy quantity of tweets. Let's give a warm welcome to Michael Barbera. So, Mike, nice to finally meet you. I know we've spoken at length across LinkedIn, and it was good for me to find a kindred spirit, someone who is as focused as I am, or even more of a focus, it looks, on customer development and the whole psychology of the consumer and the buying process, which is why I've invited you down today to interview you on Rock the Block, the podcast that is focused on technology startups and what they should be doing to succeed. And this is where I feel that this interview is going to be something amazing. So I'm really hoping that we get something great from you today.
I think we absolutely could. And I'm grateful that you think that I'm focused, because I feel like I'm a complete mess. I feel like I'm all over the place.
No, well, I mean, only you can tell me that, Mike, but you're looking like you're doing all the right things.
All I can do is try.
So, Mike, tell me about your topic, all right? Let's hear what I do from someone else who also does the same thing. I think this could be something that even I'm really intrigued to learn about.
Okay. So there are primarily three things that we do. We research, we advise, and we train. Now, the research part is a client will come to us, or a potential client will say, hey, Mike, we want to know, we're about to launch this product in 4 months or 6 months or 6 years, and we want to know this about our target audience. Can you do the research for us? What I'll say is, well, why don't you know this information already? Well, we don't have the data. And we hear that a lot. And companies often have a plethora of data. They're sitting on it. They just don't see it. They don't know what it means, don't know how to analyze it, don't know how to access it or use it. So before we say we'll do any kind of research, we will want to use their data and then try to answer their questions or concerns about their consumer. So an example could be, a financial management company came to us with a problem, says, okay, we launched this new wealth management service and we want to have a 4% conversion rate. Okay, let me see your target audience. And they showed it to us. Now, where do you think you've gone wrong? They gave us a bunch of examples, but really what happened was they're only getting 2%. So we took that same target audience, used their data, found some gaps, and what we did was we added one more attribute or behavior to the target customer. We added on a fact that if the person named their home, so if you went to that person's home and they said, oh, this is the cottage at Helm Street, that's the person you want to target. And not only did we achieve that 4%, we actually got it up to 4.6% in the conversion rate.
Wow. So little things about,
we try. We weren't looking for that behavior originally. It just popped up in the data. So really coming down to it, we're using hard data to answer questions that previously most people would make intuitive decision makings. Intuitive decisions.
Okay. So you've got a team of data scientists behind you. Is that what you're telling me?
We do. So there's three skill sets that come together on our team. The first one is data scientists. You have to understand how to source data, how to know it's reliable, how to analyze it, and how to actually present what it means. The second person we have on our team, or the second skill set, is going to be people who work in psychology, social psychology, behavioral science. And then the other one's going to be business strategy, because you can have you can have people who are experts in behavioral science and data, but if you don't know how to apply it to a business strategy, it might not be sustainable. I'll tell you a story. I went to an academic conference about a year ago, and there was some of these great academic speakers talking about their research and applying these marketing campaigns to certain organizations. And in concept, they sound amazing. Like, this is a phenomenal marketing campaign. I would love to apply this. The significant challenge, it's too resource heavy. It's not sustainable. A company would put too much resources into it, capital, time, people, and it would just not be sustainable. And it will likely sink the business because it's too many resources going to one campaign and the return on investment's not there.
Okay. And in terms of the business as it is, I mean, just before we started speaking, you mentioned a rebrand and you're going through all of that. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what you're going to be doing in September. But what compelled you to become who you are and what you do? Why are you here now?
So that's a really good question. This all started when I was 13 years old. Now, let me say a little thing here. When I was 13 years old, I never said I wanted to be a behavioral economist. I didn't know what that was. And when I was 13, it was barely even a thing. So At 13 years old, I resided in New York City. I was a drummer in a rock band. And at that age, doing that kind of skill set, I envisioned my life was going to be on tour with Metallica and Iron Maiden for the next 30 years. It doesn't work out like that. Sorry to break everyone's hearts. It's not the typical career route. But as a drummer in a rock band, everyone else in the band was older than I. And our guitarist, his family had a home with a backyard. And if you have a home with a backyard in New York City, you're pretty damn cool.
Yeah.
We would have his Halloween concert every year. But this one year, his parents were selling the home, so we couldn't use the backyard for the concert. And I'm thinking, there's got to be another way to do this. There's got to be another place we can put on the same concert and have fun with it. So I get on the telephone, and this is pre-internet days, and I start calling nightclubs, venues, concert halls, the local meeting halls, bingo halls, and ask if I could rent out their space and put on this concert. So I go out to this place called The Caves out in Staten Island, New York. Okay. And I go talk to the owner, operator, manager, and I present what I want to do. And he's like, yeah, let's do it. And now at 13 years old, I looked like I was 22. So as long as I didn't drink alcohol or misbehave in any way or do any adverse behavior, no one was going to question my authority being there. So we put on this concert, two stages, all day long, 20-something bands, and made a profit. Like, all right, that's pretty cool. What does a 13-year-old do with all this money? Do another concert. The owner, operator, manager said, let's do it again. And we kept doing it. And it turns out that this owner, operator, manager was AJ Perro. Now, to most people, that doesn't mean anything, but he was the drummer for Twisted Sister. So kind of the first person I've ever known who was semi-quasi-famous, but he acted as an unofficial mentor. We didn't sit down and have meetings about how I can improve as an entrepreneur, but I learned from watching and observing what he did and did not do. And that really turned into a business. And then, you know, make a really long story short, that business got acquired by Catalyst Promotions, who's still in business today out of Tampa, Florida.
Nice.
And then from there, I just kept doing consulting and marketing. And really my interests, my really desire to learn was how people made decisions. And through the consulting and marketing, I found there was decision science and behavioral economics. And I pursued the academic route in there as well. So there's business practitioner Mike, and then there's academic publishing research Mike, two different hats that wear, same topic, but it's two different intents and initiatives at the end. So really that's how I just matured into it. And you know, this is not the end of the story. Once ClickSuasion Labs does its thing, I might find myself doing something new in the future, and who knows what's going to happen 30 years from now.
Yeah, and I totally agree. So, I mean, that's an amazing story, and I love the stories that people tell me. So, like, kudos to you on the entrepreneur's journey, 13 to 30, and he's there, and although you was the big kid, right? You did say that you was the tall boy that was there looking at 22 at 13. But, you know, Why do you find this so important? I mean, my audience are typically, you know, they're entrepreneurs in various stages of business development. And I will totally say something now that you will agree with, that is more often than not, most people feel that when they've done their buyer profiles, they've done it, right? They've broke the bread and it's not the profile that's the problem, and it's to do with the marketing and it's the content. And 9 times out of 10, and even quite recently, just to drop this in, I presented Stansted the Airport. There was like some of the big Emirates Airlines and stuff there. And I was talking about customer development. And a couple of days ago, someone contacted me. They're a music technology startup, so similar to where you was probably 13 years ago. And she says, look, Paul, I really want to start doing some social media marketing. I've come in, but what I want is some support. And I said, yeah, cool. I can work with you in support, but I need to do this buyer persona work. I need to develop the profiles, right? Because I'm not going to get into a situation where down the line you're going to say to me, no, it's not working. And, you know, and I don't want to say, well, I wanted to do this persona work and you didn't want to do it. She said, no, Paul, listen to me. I've done lots of work. And I said, I hear this quite a lot. So let's trade off. I said, I wrote quite an easy ebook that's supposed to be, you know, like a step-to-step guide of how to go from zero to persona. And I really would like you to just compare what's in this ebook to what you've got on record. And if you are happy that what's in this ebook has been covered, then that's cool. That's fine with me. So then, yeah, off I go. Next morning, I'm on the train out to Stansted Airport, and I'm playing with my slides. And pow, 11:31, the email comes in the inbox. She's like, oh, I really need to do some more work on my personas. Like, we haven't done anything that we should be doing. And I want to do this buyer persona workshop with you. And I was like, cool, look, let's do it. But what really, really hit home there was that so many people find this part of the work in the marketing funnel, it's really unsexy, it's unglamorous, and it is data consuming, right? So, you know, they're not focused on it. It's like, no, we've done that. We don't want to do that. But having an audience that I had there captured, and then being able to take, you know, you all think that you're doing it really well, and we all like to think we're doing it really well because no one wants to be told they're doing anything wrong. But here's an email that I just got from someone 2 hours ago on the train on the way down here. So it's a late slide to the edition. And look what she says. Look, we thought we'd done it. And actually, just reading your book, first four chapters told me I hadn't done it properly. So, you know, it happens. But coming back to what I wanted to ask you was that my audience, they're going to be in the same way. They're going to be in the same position. Potentially not even done any work around personas or customer science or psychology, whichever you want to term the phrase. But what would you say to a crowded room? You've got 30 blockchain entrepreneurs, which is a brand new scene. You know, ultimately, customer psychology and customer development has basic practices, and then it has elevated practices. Tell me what you want to tell them.
Not everyone is going to want to buy your product. It hurts my heart when I hear entrepreneurs or marketing managers say, we're going to target everyone. Everyone's going to buy this. Everyone's going to love it. No, not everyone's going to buy it. Even Apple doesn't sell to everyone. They have about 50% of the market. Same thing with Android. You have to know the behaviors of who's going to buy or maybe potentially buy your product. Because if you're spending time and money and trying to target individuals or a segment of the population who does not want to engage with your product, you're wasting time and money. By narrowing it down to a specific, say, target avatar, Boisterous Bob. Boisterous Bob is 45 to 54 years old, loves Formula One racing, skydiving, weekend trips through the mountains with his Porsche, earns between 350 and 400,000 euros annually, and is married with one child. If that's your foundation of your persona, you know who to target. So you're not going to go target the single mother who's on assistance from the government and barely eating. That's a difficult time, because you're going to put money into targeting a person who is probably never going to buy something from you.
Exactly. Right. And you know, I always talk about the difference between a profile and a persona, right? And at a good level, you've touched on how someone can do some work to build the basis of a profile, right? But let's talk about the difference between a profile and a persona, right? Because for me, a profile has some rudimentary understanding of what this woman or man may look like and what their lifestyle was like and where they went to school. But, you know, there are more powerful things that you need to find out about the behavior and the emotion that goes into the buy-in process, right? Would you agree?
I do agree. So, for example, here in the United States, if you're targeting someone who is, say, above 55 years of age, mm-hmm. you never want to use the word deal when communicating with them, because more than likely, sometime in their life of 55 plus years, they've been given the opportunity for a good deal, and it probably wasn't a good deal. So the word deal is something you do not want to use, because they're going to associate your product or service you're offering with that negative experience they had sometime in the past.
Okay, so let's flip that on its head, right? Because a blockchain audience can typically be quite millennial. What are good buzzwords that you know that resonate with the millennial market?
Well, that's really difficult to say, because millennials can be right now between 21, 22 years old and between, say, maybe 34, 35, I think, without doing some long form math.
Yeah.
So when you have a 22-year-old millennial, that could be someone who is recently graduating college, someone who is really struggling with college debt, or is brand new to the workforce. That 34-year-old millennial could be someone who has been in the workforce for 12 years. They could be an entrepreneur or some kind of just regular employee. But they can also have a family with two or three kids and two very different people in the millennials. So when you break it down by generation, I think it's a really good practice to break it down even further as much as possible until you know what kind of dust was on the hospital bill when they were born.
I love that saying. I might have to pinch that. So, you know, we've talked a little bit about the journey, why we both love what we're doing. You know, I think you've given us some great tips there in short. But what are the common myths that we can debunk in this conversation, right? Because I just feel that it's such an unloved part of the business, right? Until the business gets to a certain size. And then all of a sudden, it's all about the customer and the data, right? So what is it that turns people off in that SME space of doing, you know, some laborious and intensive work in customer psychology?
So one of the things that turns people away from a product, a service, or a brand is the lack of trust, authenticity, and or transparency. Now, this does hit home with a lot of millennials, regardless if you are that 22-year-old or that 34-year-old millennial. But it also hits home as well with the 55-plus target audience or other generations as well, even with Gen Z now approaching the college age and college graduation. If you try to offer something without some kind of transparency, authenticity, or just without basic trust from the customer, or the customer does not trust you, it's going to be very difficult to persuade someone to follow through. Now, there are outliers. Someone will always click through and buy something from you. But to have the person come back and to have a significant or above average return, you're going to want to have some trust. And by showing vulnerabilities, by showing weaknesses is a good way to go. So for example, right now, Wells Fargo, the large bank in the United States, and Facebook have two PR campaigns that are explaining their weaknesses and say, hey, we had your trust for 50 plus years. This is Wells Fargo. We've had your trust for 50 plus years or 100 plus years, and we've gone wrong. And now we're going back to the building blocks, and we're starting again to build and capture your trust and to work with you like we always did. And Facebook is having a similar PR challenge where they've lost the trust of a lot of people because of data misuse. And there's different perceptions about it, because now in the EU you have the GDPR, and in the US we don't have anything like that. Data is almost free game except for in the state of California. So now companies are trying to build people's trust or gain people's trust back in order to sustain that loyalty.
Okay. I think that's really interesting. And from your experience, I mean, I know you're dealing with some really big brands now, and you have been for some time, but you know, when you're your own journey and you first started getting into this kind of activity, from a business owner's perspective, what were the things that you used to find were the challenges in getting people to commit to doing some psychology around the customer buying process?
Usually it comes down to finances. Since you're saying business owner, I'm going to assume you're referring to small or medium-sized businesses.
Yeah, completely.
So when it comes to using social psychology or consumer psychology, this is not really the something that a small or medium-sized business owner would seek out on their own. Usually they come across it in a book and they say, oh, you know, I want to learn more, or someone in their peer group will recommend it to them, or they come across it some other way. It's not something that's really sought out. Now, when they do seek it out, they don't have to know all of the science behind it, but they know that when you shake someone's hand, you make eye contact, you touch their elbow, it's personal touches, you use certain words, you frame messages certain ways, you present the problem first, followed by a solution. These are basic ways, and they don't work with every target audience. But I think every business owner is using psychology in some way, shape, or form that they've either learned or figured out through application on their own.
Okay, cool. So, I mean, listen, I think we've really gone through it and you've definitely answered the questions that I wanted answering. So let me ask you some other questions.
Not at all.
Okay, all right, we're done. All right, brilliant. Your own personal journey, let's look at that, right? You've been building your personal brand as well as the business brand. And what hurdles have you faced personally and what did you do to overcome them?
Well, there's a lot of hurdles. So I shared the story earlier about growing up as a young entrepreneur, as a teenager, and when I was 13 years old, and we had success stories. We had an M&A when I was like 17 years old. Mm-hmm. We had all these great concerts. It doesn't mean there was failures. We've had plenty of concerts where nobody showed up and we took significant losses. But they're all learning lessons. And the lessons come every day. Just because we are now still growing, we have positive growth, we're hiring more people, doesn't mean we're perfect. We're flawed like everyone else. The brands are what you see from the outside, but in the inside, no matter which company it is, whether it's ClickSuasion Labs, Wells Fargo, Facebook, or even IBM, we all have flaws that are not always privy to the public. And once we identify that we've done something wrong, I think that the win there is when you identify it and then you work to fix it. If you identify it or you feel that you've identified a problem and you don't fix it, that could be a hurdle and a challenge for a business to grow. For myself personally, there's a lot of hurdles. I'll share one. I'll show my vulnerability. A lot of our company's direct competitors are consistently mentioned in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. We don't have that type of journalistic clout. Now, the majority of our competitors are not-for-profit organizations who have a different mission than we do, but they have the talent and they can immediately pivot if they want to and be a significant competitor. So we call them competitors for that reason.
Yeah.
We don't have that journalistic clout. We have a decent amount of journalistic clout, but not the way they do. So now we are working behind the scenes to build our relationship with journalists and broadcast journalists and the media, publication editors to get our name out there and compete with them on that kind of level.
Okay. I mean, that's understandable. I'm going through the same thing. I've recently hired a communications expert, not only to enable and facilitate that activity, but also to help me hone and drive the business and personal brand messaging home as well. And I'm sure you can appreciate that takes some time, especially for someone like myself, who's, I wouldn't say I'm a control freak, but I'm very in control and very on the ball when it comes to how I want to be perceived. So, you know, it is a hard thing. But, you know, another question which I always love to ask people to come on the show is, what profession other than your own would you like to attempt to do?
So I'm going to answer that two ways. if money was never, ever an issue and I could do whatever I wanted to do, I would love to dress up as a mascot at a professional baseball game or football or whatever it may be, and just be the mascot running around the field and engaging with fans. I think that is so much fun. That's my absolute dream job.
Okay.
Now, the entrepreneur side of me, I would love, and I've tried this before and failed. It just takes a lot of resources, a lot of methodologies, and I don't have the resources to commit to it. Mm-hmm. Is to kind of create the Yelp of journalism, where journalists can be rated, and not only the journalists themselves, but the media organizations they work for. So, you know, John Smith is a broadcast journalist for the BBC. John's obviously made up name. John Smith has a 4.3 out of 5 stars, and he needs all the comments based upon the legitimacy or the reliability of his or her reporting. And then coincides with that, you have the same same rating for the BBC as well. And those ratings will follow the organization or the individual journalist throughout their entire career, just as a business would on Google ratings or Yelp or et cetera. Now, recently, it's been released, semi-released to the public that Elon Musk created a similar platform called Pravda.
Yeah.
And it's not released yet, but I applaud him, and I would love to share all my resources that I've used for our project with this, the similar project, because we can't make it happen, and I'd like to see someone else make it happen. So congratulations to him.
Nice, nice, and well done for congratulating a fellow entrepreneur. I love that. Okay, so I'm going to try and wrap this up, and I always do by asking you like a really couple of stupid questions just to kind of get more of a feeling for the kind of person you are. So I'm just going to pick one or two. What's your favorite word?
Ooh, really good question. My favorite word. You've stumped me. I don't think I've ever been asked that question, or I don't think I've ever been put in a position where I need to self-reflect on what my favorite word is. You know what? If I have to choose one for this moment, I will say my apologies. Now, or apologies. That's two words, or just use the word apologies. It would be one, and here's why. It's very common for people to say, I'm sorry. Oh, I was a few minutes late. I'm sorry. Bump into you by accident with my shoulder. I'm sorry. Yeah. So I'm sorry is so overused that it has no more meaning anymore. So if you reframe the message and say, Paul, my apologies, it has more significance, more meaning, and it's more heartfelt. It's more authentic.
Yeah, yeah, that does carry more weight. I totally agree.
Until we all say it, then we define a new word.
Yeah, that is a problem. But okay. And what are you not very good at?
What am I not very good at? Law. Okay. You know what? Teaching mathematics. So I work in data. I consider myself a data scientist. I use math all the time in the calculator form, in the software form, the SPSS, Tableau, et cetera. I'm reading through statistical models. But if I had to teach it, it would be an absolute disaster.
Oh, wow. Okay. So so better to deliver than to teach, yeah?
Yes.
Listen, I think it's been fantastic talking to you. I'm really glad that you've come on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure. You're definitely one of my best appearances so far. So please do take that away. And that is a heartfelt and warm compliment. And you know what? I'm hoping that I can catch up with you face-to-face at some point. In the future, and hopefully collaborate on something, because I think we've got some good synergy and some good energy.
I agree. I appreciate you having me on here. I hope your listeners got something decent out of this. I'm not perfect. I just share what I know, and I don't know what I don't know. And whenever you plan to come across the pond, let me know, and I will do the same for you.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you very much. Ladies My and pleasure. Gentlemen, there we go. This is the end of Rock the Block.
Thanks for listening to ClickSuasion. Subscribe to the podcast, read our research, and get in touch with us at ClickSuasion.com. You can also find us on Twitter with the handle @ClickSuasion.